What is a posteriori? What does that mean? A posteriori from last week. Sense experience. Knowledge that comes after sense experience. What's a priori? In a sense, it's before or prior to. We like to think of it as independent of sense experience. So things you can think about without having any experiences of the natural world. What about scientism? What's scientism? Okay, the view that science gives knowledge about everything. What else can we add to that? Yes. Yeah, believing in the scientific method, maybe to do more than what it is capable of doing. Yeah. So what does scientism say about other fields of knowledge? This is actually relevant for this class too, what we're going to talk about.
Science is the only source of knowledge?
Yes. Very good. You weren't even here. Genius. So scientism claims that science is the only source of knowledge, so all the other fields of knowledge are what?
Obsolete.
Yes, what else? Not worth knowing? Invalid, yeah. All these other fields are just pretty much worthless. They're just worthless. They're a waste of your time. So tonight, what we're going to talk about is kind of along those lines, but a little bit more involved, a little bit more challenging, I suppose. But the topic, and as we go through, it'll be pretty straightforward. Now, before we go any further, though, I want to quiz you a little bit more. I'm going to give you a word or a phrase. I want you to put it under the category of empiricism or rationalism. Okay, so just say empiricism or rationalism back to me. A priori, what would that fall under? What is it? A priori would fall under something like rationalism, because it has to do with thinking away from knowledge. What about a posteriori, empiricism or rationalism? Empiricism. What about this no innate ideas, empiricism or rationalism? That we don't have innate ideas. It would be empiricism. We don't have innate ideas, whereas rationalism says we do have innate ideas, right? Okay, empiricism or rationalism? Reason-based knowledge. Reason-based knowledge. Rationalism. What about this one? Experience-based knowledge. Empiricism. What about this one? Requires observation. Empiricism or rationalism? Empiricism. What about this one? No observation is required for knowledge. Rationalism. What about this one? Necessary truths. Necessary truths. Rationalism. Things that you can know to be true regardless of what possible universe you are in. Contingent truths. Empiricism. Contingent meaning that things could be otherwise. It could have been different. They didn't have to unfold the way they did. If we go out and observe them, we find that these things are contingent. They're depending on something. How about this one? Deductive. What does that resonate with? Empiricism or rationalism? Deductive reasoning. Rationalism. Because it's things you know to be true without looking at the world. You can deduce things in your head. All A is B, all B is C, therefore all A is C. This is deductive reasoning. How about inductive reasoning? Empiricism. Inductive meaning you build a case based on a bunch of data that you accumulate. So you inductively create a case to show the truth of something. Okay? I just want to throw these at you, these terms, because what we're trying to do with this class, as we critique and tear down these other views, we also want to build up these categories of knowledge and this vocabulary for ourselves so that we can have tools to use when we encounter these ideas. Because they're not going to come so straightforward sometimes. So we have to be able to have an ability to categorize and think with a good vocabulary. I guarantee you, if you learn vocabulary, this sort of vocabulary, you will be very effective in your evangelistic methods and approaches. So consider some of those things we just brought up and make it part of what you go research and get familiarized with. Okay, in your handout, I just gave you a one-page handout. I'd like you to just pull that in front of you. What you're going to see here is just a couple simple ideas. And we've talked through these before, but I'm trying to get them ingrained into you. And I'm sorry for if I've repeated myself on this, but this is something so foundational that it's worth really repeating. So this is the Christian view of knowledge, okay? So we, as Christians, hold that God exists, and that with God's existence and this view of foundationalism and realism, when you add all that together, we have the capability for acquiring knowledge. So these three things are necessary for knowledge. The non-Christian has challenges. He would either come from skepticism or maybe logical positivism, like we'll see tonight, or something like this, naturalism. And he tries to get to knowledge, but it's a little bit more difficult for him. For us, it's easy. We have a source of being, we have a source of ideas, we have a source of truth, and we hold to the views of foundationalism and realism. So with foundationalism, it's basically, you could kind of just think of it like this. I've tried to take the definition and reduce it just so it's as simplistic as possible for you. So with foundationalism, there is a foundation to our knowledge structure that does not require further justification. Okay, so just think of a building with foundations. In order to build a building, you have to have firm foundations. And without firm foundations, your building will fall. It'll fail. And something has to ground your building's columns and walls and things like that. So with this, we have this idea of something being properly basic. So this is, in our case, an example is direct awareness of the Holy Spirit. So we have this properly basic concept that the Holy Spirit is speaking to us or moving on us, and we can know him. We as Christians say that this is foundational. So that we have this idea of something being properly basic. That's just one example. The other thing is self-evident. There are self-evident truths out there, like this. Killing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong. This is self-evident, okay? It's logically obvious. Some things are just logically obvious, like 2 + 2 = 4. Simple logical truths like that. This is part of foundationalism. Or these are components, if you will, these little things in quotations. Simple seeing. I am me and I am not you. These are just simple. You just reflect on it just for a moment, just a moment's reflection, and you can see simply that I am me and not you. And then commonsensical is another component to foundationalism. I see the rock in front of me and I know it's not a turtle. I know it's a rock. I can just tell. It's just common sense. So these are just kind of rough examples of this idea of what is it to have foundational truths. And then we talked about knowledge being justified true belief. Do you remember that? JTB, justified true belief. That's the idea that if I have a claim to knowledge, say that Jesus rose from the grave or God exists, I make this claim and I say, I know this. I don't just believe it, I know it. I'm saying that I have a justified true belief. I don't just have a belief, but my belief is true and it's justified. So when someone claims that they know God doesn't exist, they have a lot of work to do to make that belief justified and true. So we, on the other hand, have less work to do to show that God exists. But anyway, justified true belief is what knowledge is. Okay? And how you get there is kind of what I've given you in those God existence, foundationalism, plus realism is knowledge. And then knowledge doesn't require certainty or an inexhaustible knowledge. We don't have to be 100% certain. We don't have to be 90% certain to have knowledge. We could just have knowledge. So our certainty meter, hopefully, though, is above 50%. And we don't have to know things in their entirety. We don't have to have exhaustive knowledge of X, Y, or Z to say, I know X, Y, or Z. We can have some knowledge of X, Y, or Z to say we know X, Y, or Z. So I don't have to have been there when Jesus rose from the grave. I know he rose from the grave based on eyewitness testimony, based on the reliability of the scriptures, based on the emergence of the church, and other various forms of evidence. So this is just something to keep in mind when you're talking to a non-believer about what we know. We need to be able to remember this. This needs to be part of our thinking, because without this breakdown, it's hard to meet the challenge directly. We'll struggle a little bit. And lastly, there's realism. Realism, it could be thought about in two different ways: epistemological realism and metaphysical realism. Epistemological realism is objective reality is knowable. So this is saying that, remember, epistemology is how we know the world, how we acquire knowledge. So we're saying that objective reality, the real world out there, is actually knowable. We can have we have direct access to it. We can know it. Skeptics don't agree with that. Metaphysical realism is the idea that objective reality is really there, that we're not just brains in a vat. We're not just plugged into some machine that's feeding us signals to our head to inform us that a world is out there, but it's not really there. We hold that a real world is actually out there, an objective world that has nothing to do with my subjective experience of it. In other words, it's mind independent. Okay, so like things like objective morality is a realm of the world that is mind independent, that killing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong, because not because I think about it's morally wrong, but because it is in fact morally wrong. It's objectively wrong. So when you hear the word objective, think mind independent. Things true regardless of whether or not I think about them or you think about them. They are just true in and of themselves. Who decides morality? Okay, so now this is that question comes from a relativistic perspective. In relativism, we will find that is based in postmodernism, which we'll talk about in a few weeks. So, no one. The answer is no one.
Yeah. Because everybody that you give a good reputation to will want to have that.
Yeah.
They want to be like those things. They want to have those attributes. But they are not formalized in their arguments with regards to unbelief. Okay? And so I found that I was viewing them as subordinated to my view. They were not peers. They were not on the same platform.
Yeah.
And I had a greater standing. I had attained. They had I was unaccepting of their unacceptance.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And it's one of these things where this is, like I mentioned to you, and I try to keep emphasizing, maybe if you get some of these emails, to read that first week's chunk of class notes, because I really try to talk about how we approach this conversation, how we approach each other, and how we approach this discipline and field. We can't do it, people, if we are not doing it with incredible humility. We will drown in our own pride, and it'll be disgusting. You don't want that. We want to have a way. This is actually, I was going to talk about this later, so you'll get it now. So this idea of a straw man, have you heard of it? So if we keep creating, as Christians, straw men to beat up, we're really not talking to real people about their real worldviews. We want to understand their worldview for what it is in all of its glory and treat it with the utmost respect. And in philosophy, we call this the principle of charity. So we want to give the other position, we want to put it in a better light than they put it in themselves. A lot of times, they don't even know how bad their view is, and then they start articulating it, and it sounds terrible. And then if we're good, we could kind of pick that up and say, oh, do you mean this, you know, and help them with their view. And we need to put it in a good light so that when we beat it up, we're not beating up their worst. We're beating up their best. And they will find that very respectful. They will feel respected because you treated them and their view and their position and how they think about things and their whole life with respect. Because a lot of times, our worldview comes from our life experiences. You know, say a parent died, you know, and they went into Scientology or something, you know. So we really want to understand them and how they think in the best possible light and help their view actually gain some ground. And then we critique it with appropriate methods, like Kokel's Tactics. You may remember reading that in some of the notes. His book Tactics is a really good book if you don't have it. How to ask the right question at the right time. So I just want to express to you that remember the principle of charity and remember not to create straw man arguments. And what I'm trying to do, my best, is to create very good presentations of their view before I critique it. So I hope we just remember that. Yes, ma'am. Big debate. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's something we need to, when we watch these debates and these presentations, we need to learn from the William Lane Craigs and maybe the Ken Hams of the world who are going into this public engagement, and we need to learn from them. These guys are our models, so we can follow in their footsteps in that sense. Yes. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 13, if you read that in a sense where we are treating other people with the love that Paul is talking about, in the light of evangelism, maybe reread that and think through, what does this mean for evangelistic methods? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You got 60 seconds, and you want to try to tell them their worldview fails, and they need Jesus, and go ahead and let's convert right now. You know, it's like, it's practically impossible, right? But what we can do, like Kokel says, is we can ask the piercing question that will sit with them in such a way that it's like a pebble in their shoe. So they keep walking around the rest of the week, and they're just like, something's a little off. And then hopefully we can encourage another encounter, and we can continue the conversation. So that's what we got to do. I mean, we can't just, unless there's a moment where we can just share the gospel, boom, and go for it. Yeah, we need to do that. We need to be ready and willing and ready to pull the trigger and, can you know, bring people to Jesus as fast as possible. Yes, sir. You know, that's a great, response. I think with what Chris is saying is like there's a way where we could take and something that's kind of natural in the flow of our communication that's very friendly and loving, and we can use that and we can re-maneuver this conversation, redirect it based on what that conversation is already about. But it takes practice. It takes practice. So let's go ahead and get going into this because we have a lot of work to do. Okay, so there are some popular sayings that we would typically encounter along the lines of verificationism. We'll talk about what that is in a moment. So you may have heard something like this. There is no way to evidentially prove that God exists because by definition, he is spirit. By definition, he's spirit, so you can't prove him evidentially. Or you may have heard something like this. Religious people can't know that God exists because God is not something that we can detect. So religious people just really don't have knowledge. How about this? Religious language is meaningless because it can't report facts of the universe like science can. So all that we say is meaningless because it doesn't have anything to do with facts. Science gives us facts. How about this? Talk about God is like meaningless talk about leprechauns, fairies, mermaids, and unicorns. All are fantasies without evidence. You see the theme here, probably. And this last one maybe you've heard, God is not meaningfully defined. The word God does not refer to anything. So the very concept of God, that thing you just uttered, that noise, God, doesn't refer to anything. It's just a meaningless noise you just made. So, believe it or not, these sayings are rooted in philosophy. And so in order to appropriately respond to these sayings, we need to look at the philosophical movements of logical positivism and verificationism. So during the time of the logical positivism movement, assessments like these were being said of its impact. So it was a very impactful thing. And here's some commentators. They say, the main danger to theism comes from the people who want to say that God exists and God does not exist are equally absurd. The concept of God, they would say, is a nonsensical one. So this professor says that the main danger to theism comes from the idea that God exists and God does not exist. Those are equally absurd concepts. They're meaningless. They're just nonsense. That is the main danger to theism. And then another professor says, it is one of the most radical challenges ever offered to theology, since it concerns not simply the truth, but the very meaning of religious statements. So now we're getting beyond what's true and what's false. We're just talking about what's meaningful and what's meaningless. So today, logical positivism has led to perhaps the number one charge against God, used by popular atheists, people that you kind of meet on the street, This is one charge that atheists have voted in a YouTube page as the number one charge against God. They said that this charge is the top one against God. God is not meaningfully defined. The word God does not refer to anything. So that's what 1,000 atheists voted as the best charge against God, that he's not meaningfully defined, and the word God doesn't refer to anything. And then I know personally some atheists that can't even begin to discuss God until you work out with them a theory of meaning that they will agree upon. So, and not just what meaning is by definition, but a theory of meaning, a philosophy of meaning. So atheists get really caught up here. So tonight we're going to look at some of these views of logical positivism, verificationism. We're going to examine where they come from. We're going to understand the implications of these views, and we're going to show the criticisms of these views, and then we're going to determine if they stand up to scrutiny or not, and if we have time, respond to these views. All right. So let's get into this. We'll first look at logical positivism and verificationism, and then we'll look at falsification, the falsification principle. All right, so logical positivism and verificationism. So logical positivism, you may not like this word already or this expression, but it's simply this. It denies the legitimacy of philosophical problems and claims that empirical science provides the only meaningful knowledge. So basically, it denies what philosophers typically consider to be the problems of the human condition, like what is real, what is knowledge, what is right and wrong, things like that. So it denies the legitimacy of those philosophical problems and says those are all worthless pursuits, and it just claims that empirical science provides the only meaningful knowledge. So it just basically does away with a lot of philosophy and says, all you needed to know is what science can give you, and that's what's meaningful. So it kind of is really simplistic. So logical is just the relationship of ideas, like logic. And positivism is just a word that you could think of as empiricism. Things that are matters of fact, things that are empirical, things that science can tell us. So positivism, just when you hear that word, think of empiricism, just to make it easy on you. And you could probably cross out the word and math there in the parentheses, because math is not an empirical sort of thing. So it really belongs, the math part kind of belongs up there with the logical part, with the relationship of ideas. So again, logical positivism is basically the relationship of ideas that have to do with empiricism. So this view emphasizes a logical analysis of language. So they like to cut up our statements and analyze them. There's a subject, a direct object, a verb. They cut it up and they analyze things to death. That's the analytical movement in philosophy. So logical positivism thought that philosophy is the activity of clarifying language by logical analysis and by destroying meaningless propositions. Again, propositions are just statements. So philosophy is the activity of getting rid of bad language and keeping good language after you do a logical analysis with it. And you want to find things that are meaningful. So they wanted to redefine philosophy as a field whose sole purpose is to find meaning in language. That was their goal. So for them, philosophy is the logical analysis of statements, and they sought to develop a very tough-minded empiricism, or tough-minded empirical approach to knowledge, where science is what counts as knowledge, and all else is simply meaningless. So logical positivists wanted to show that metaphysics was and is meaningless. So metaphysics is what? What is metaphysics? We've talked about this a little bit. The study of reality. The study of reality. So metaphysics is a field in philosophy that tries to understand the real world out there, or if there is such a thing. So metaphysical items, if you will, are things like minds, abstract things like numbers, things like that. So is there such a thing as numbers? Is there such a thing as a mind? What about personhood? Is there such a thing as personhood or human persons? Is there such a thing as a human person? Not a human person, but the universal human person that we all exemplify. Is God a person? You know, these are the concepts that metaphysics tries to think through. So they wanted to destroy metaphysics. They wanted to get rid of metaphysics altogether. Why? Because if they could attack metaphysical systems, they could also show that religious language is meaningless. That God is a meaningless concept because he's purely a metaphysical being, and what is metaphysical does not provide meaning. So we don't want things that are meaningless. We want to get rid of God. Yeah. Well, you're. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this is the critique, right? So you're skipping ahead here. This is leading to you guys are so good. You beat up everything I say. No, but yeah, this is secular humanism arising out of this. But we're going to see that in the coming weeks. I mean, we're taking a journey. Logical positivism. You can see here now, it's a good segue. Where did this view come from? How did it develop? Well, it has its philosophical roots in empiricism, scientism, naturalism, and skepticism. You can see there that little chart. We already talked about in the 1600s, Francis Bacon's inductive method and scientific method and scientism and empiricism. And we already talked about in the 1700s, Descartes and Hume's views and their skepticism, which led to rationalism and empiricism. We already talked about in the 1800s, naturalism. We didn't talk about Darwin and Huxley because these things are kind of more well known, but you can see naturalism really gaining ground and its roots just expanding throughout the entire Western world in the 1800s with Darwin's book, Origin of Species. And now in the 1900s, we see all these movements coming out. Logical positivism, existentialism, postmodernism, pragmatism, relativism, and pluralism. All sorts of other worldviews and philosophical movements arising that have been influenced by these predecessor worldviews. So this is just kind of a crude way to think through how these things overlap, how these things influence each other, and we've already been talking about those. So now we're kind of moving into some views of the last 100 years. Okay? So then you can see from the other diagram the influence of the new analytic philosophical movement on the early 20th century. So again, you have empiricism, scientism, naturalism, and skepticism up there on the left. Hume's fork, which we'll talk about hopefully a little bit later if we have time. And then analytic philosophy. Again, analytic philosophy is just taking a bunch of statements of language and making them into like essentially mathematical expressions. So you can create, you know, God exists is A, and then you have a symbol of logic, we'll just say plus, and then you have God exists as a infinitely good being, you know, let's just say, and then you have, you know, therefore he loves us, you know, something like this. So they're taking, this is what analytic philosophy is doing essentially, but it gets much more complicated than that. Analytic philosophy?
All the centuries,
All
these isms,
yeah.
Are
they going towards God? Definitely away. So with these movements and these isms coming up, you see just secularism gaining ground in the public square and Christianity decreasing. Yeah. So, and again, here you see this idea of analytic philosophy in this third little chart influencing these other movements or these other movements coming out of analytic philosophy, and on the second one in, logical positivism is one that we're going to talk about tonight with the Vienna Circle. We'll get into that in a second. All right, so this is just a little backdrop. yeah, what are those categories are important for this conversation because he actually 200. Yeah, he essentially yes. And then from that we see that influencing logical positivism. Yeah, so he was a man before his time, so to speak. He was very brilliant in that sense. Okay, so roots of these views could be seen from all these movements in Hume's fork from the 18th century. And so, interestingly, logical positivism, as we'll see, suffers from some of the same fates that these other views have suffered from. So we'll get into that. So logical positivism resulted from a form of positivism, empiricism, you could say, in what was called the Vienna Circle after the First World War in the 1920s. So the Vienna Circle was a group of Austrian philosophers who basically they sought to develop a tough-minded empiricism. And the way they did this is they created this principle, and they used this principle and they applied it to statements or propositions. And the founder of the Vienna Circle was a guy named Moritz Schlick. And this, again, was kind of right after the First World War. And there's a bunch of guys that he got together in the Austria area, a bunch of other philosophers, and he pulled them together, and they created this kind of philosophical society called the Vienna Circle. And they became very influential and very prominent and very famous. And they were so famous that Oxford students, such as this guy A.J. Ayer, who was one of the biggest atheists of last century, went over to Vienna to go learn and study with the Vienna Circle crew. And he took with him a guy named W.V. O'Quine, again, one of the most prominent atheists of last century. So these Oxford students who were getting their PhDs, let's say, higher degrees, went over there and spent some time with them. And that was quite an ordeal, if you can imagine, to travel across Europe at that time. And they went back, and this other guy named Wittgenstein, you may have heard his name, is sometimes called the best or the greatest philosopher of the last 100 years, and he was big in analytic philosophy. He also came in and out of this circle at different times. So with these people coming in and out of it, you could see the thoughts of the Vienna Circle influencing what was happening in Oxford, and then essentially that was influencing what's happening here in the philosophical societies and academic departments in America during that time. So this view was spreading. So what happened in the Vienna Circle was very important with how this view hit the streets here in America. Yes, sir. Yeah, I'm with. How do you respond to that? Well, there are some women philosophers that started to creep up right before the turn of the 1900 century. There, just a few though, and to be honest, they weren't really associated with any of these isms that I'm talking about. So, sorry. Hey, it apparently has been. I'm not making this stuff up. maybe you can go around and ask these women for the history of women in philosophy at the break, because I don't know much of it. Sorry. Okay, let's keep moving. Verification principle. So the Vienna Circle formulated what became known as the verification principle, which was later called verificationism. So again, the logical positivists thought that scientific language had a basis for What made it meaningful? So it's all about science. That's the basis for verification and the basis for meaning. So the verification principle of logical positivism was an empirical test to determine whether statements have meaning. So one could apply this test, let's say, or one could apply this mold to a proposition or a statement to determine if that statement would fit the mold. And if it fit the mold, it was meaningful. If it didn't, it wasn't meaningful. So if this test result says it's empirically verifiable, then that statement had meaning. If the test result said it's not empirically verifiable, then that statement did not have meaning. So this is the verification principle that the Vienna Circle formulated. It's a statement, they said, a statement is meaningful only if it is in principle capable of being shown to be true by empirical data. So it has to be in principle capable of being shown to be true by empirical data. So let me give you an example, or maybe you could tell me, if this statement is in principle capable of being empirically verified. Jesse is 99.99999% muscle, okay? Jesse right here, he's a buff dude. He could kill us with just one swipe of his hand. So is that statement, is that empirically verifiable in principle? Could we do some tests, let's say, to determine that? Get his body weight, measure his muscles. Biceps are like 50 inches around. We can do some tests like this, right? How about this statement? Abortion is wrong. Is that empirically verifiable? Why not? It's a moral issue. You can see it, but is it wrong? Is it wrong? Can you see wrong? Can you empirically verify wrong? Okay. According to the... You can empirically verify what is happening. You could call it disgusting, murder. You can call it everything you want. But according to the Vienna Circle, you couldn't... When you say it's wrong, you're saying blah, 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 blah. You're saying noise. You're making noise. It's not meaningful what you just said. What about this? God exists. Can you empirically verify that? Okay, hold your answer. Hold your answer for a second. Okay, so let's keep moving. Empirically verifiable, that in thing in quotes right there, empirically verifiable is the criteria of the statements to keep. That's what they're saying. So if you follow this little train of thought here, you start with this idea of what's empirically verifiable, and then you go to what's factual. So basically, if you pass the first test, then you're into this other car, if you will, of the train. So then you get factual. And then that which is factual is also meaningful. And that which is meaningful is also knowledge. And that which is knowledge is what you want to keep. Okay, whereas if something is not empirically verifiable, it's not factual, it's not meaningful, and it's not knowledge, so you discard that. So that's what you do. And that's how you start to analyze your knowledge structure. And you want to get rid of the things that are not meaningful and keep the things that are meaningful. Okay, so all traditional philosophy, like metaphysics and religion, is meaningless with no knowledge and no truth, thus it should be destroyed. So they wanted to destroy all metaphysics. Metaphysical statements are not empirically verifiable, so we discard those. So all of theology, ethics, are meaningless because they say that God fits into the metaphysical category. An atheist, A.G. Ayer, he later said this, to say that God exists is to make a metaphysical utterance which cannot be either true or false. When you say God exists, according to the Vienna Circle and the logical positivists, they're saying that you are making an utterance about something metaphysical and it can't be true or false. It's just meaningless. So God exists is a meaningless noise coming out of my mouth because it can't be empirically verified. So atheist researcher James Thrower, he says, religious as well as aesthetic, ethical and aesthetic propositions were, it was claimed, unable to meet this requirement and were therefore dismissed as nonsensical. So when you look back into those years of the popularity of the Vienna Circle, they were basically saying that all those things that were considered religious statements were discarded. So God loves us is a meaningless noise coming out of my mouth, because the proposition God loves us cannot be empirically verified. You cannot know it through your five senses. All right. So this would be a good time, I think, to take a little break. We'll try to take a real quick one this time. 3 minutes and 36 seconds. Last time I said 5 minutes and it went 12 minutes. So I'm going to time it. 3 minutes and 36 seconds. Go. The falsification principle naturally came out of the verification principle. So this is the inverse principle, if you will, of the verification principle. So the verification principle, again, is a statement is meaningful only if it is in principle capable of being shown to be true by empirical data. The falsification principle, on the other hand, says a statement is meaningful only if it is in principle capable of being shown to be false by empirical data. So let's look at this a little bit. Yes, it was a product. It came out of the Oxford Symposium in 1955, which is, again, influenced by the Vienna Circle. Yeah. It is influenced. Okay, in here, yeah, the falsification principle is something that is incapable of being empirically falsified, or something that is empirically falsifiable. So let me share with you a way to think through this. So let's take the statement, there are 30 pew benches in the sanctuary behind me. Is that statement empirically falsifiable? In other words, can you find data that would count against that statement to show that it is false? What would you have to do? You just go count it. You look at it, you see it, you count it. So in other words, there are 30 pews in this sanctuary behind me is empirically falsifiable. I can falsify the statement. Let's try another one. This church building, the architectural plans and the structural plans and all of the members and all the rafters and all the columns and all the joists and all the beams, the girders, the trusses, the shear walls, the foundation system, it's all duplicated in Manila in the Philippines. If you went to downtown Manila and you looked around, you would see this exact church there. Is that statement empirically falsifiable? Yes. Why? One moment. Easy. You had a lot of coffee tonight. Why? Why is it empirically falsifiable? Yeah, you could go take it apart and look and make sure all the studs and all the joists and all the rafters were in the exact same position this one is. It would be hard, but you could do it. What about this statement? There are 100 billion stars in the universe observable today. Is that statement empirically falsifiable in principle? In principle. In principle, it is. You can actually, if you spend enough time, you had a big enough team, you had enough instruments, and the technology was there, you could go and say, no, there's actually 101 billion trillion stars in the universe. You're off by a 1 billion trillion. You know, you could do that in principle. So do you get the idea? There are statements that we make that could be falsified. So all of those examples can be falsified. So again, a statement is meaningful according to the falsification principle. A statement is meaningful if it is in principle empirically falsifiable. So this is kind of the inverse of the verification principle. Now, where did this come from? So Antony Flew was a premier philosopher and a staunch atheist, and he was a part of the Oxford Symposium in 1955. By the way, Antony Flew, this staunch atheist, one of the biggest and best atheists of the last 100 years, he became a theist at the end of his life. Maybe you're familiar with this story. Through the work of several Christian apologists who befriended him, and over the years, he eventually held to some form of theism. Not the Christian theism that we know, but some form of theism like deism. Anyway, this was kind of groundbreaking when this story came out a few 5 years ago or so. So if you ever want to hear of one of the biggest success stories of apologetics, look up the story of Antony Flew. Anyway, in 1955, he wrote a groundbreaking essay called Theology and Falsification. And he delivered this essay in front of this Oxford Symposium that was happening at the time. And he transformed the verification principle into the falsification principle that we just talked about. He then applied this falsification principle to religious statements and redefined meaning and what's meaningful. So when the falsification principle is applied to theology, one could ask, could religious belief be disproved? If not, what does this imply? Okay. Do statements such as God exists and God loves us have any meaning if they cannot be evaluated by empirical data? So again, it's kind of the inverse of the verification principle. Okay, if things couldn't be disproved or if they can't be evaluated, then what does this mean? So Flew argues that the religious expression God exists is not meaningful. That's what he argues, okay? And he does this by starting with this parable. It was the parable of the invisible gardener. And he got this parable from someone before him named John Wisdom. And that's kind of not very important, but I just want to let you know he didn't make it up himself. But the parable goes something like this. There were two explorers traveling, 500 B.C., in the middle of Africa. These explorers happened to be named Chris, and Chris had a long blonde beard and a long blonde ponytail. And he happened to like apologetics too, you know. This. He was an Italian explorer, and he went traveling around all over Africa with Sony and Julie and Oli. And so they all went together, and they traveled around Africa, and they stumbled upon this area of bushes and trees. And the bushes and the trees were situated and arranged in what appeared to be arranged in such a way that they were planted there, and they were taken care of, and there was a kind of a bit of an order to this arrangement. They kind of had created a shape or some sort of something that would show you that a person was involved. So there was kind of a colors in the flowers, red over here, and they kind of formed a little bit of a rainbow with how the colors of the flowers were situated. And they thought, oh wow, this is very very interesting. It appears that there's a gardener taking care of this area here. It appears that someone planted these things, and so let's go find the gardener and let's go talk to him. So they looked around, and they couldn't find him, and they spent months looking for this gardener. Well. They said, well, if this gardener is really taking care of all these bushes and trees and flowers, then we ought to find him if we just stick around the garden for a while. And they did, and the gardener never came. So they built a fence, put barbed wire around it, because you had barbed wire back then. And they actually had a laser beam system where if the gardener were to cross it, the lasers would show up, sound an alarm, and you would see the gardener on the monitor because he had a full security system. And they would be able to detect the gardener. And they had this awesome grass, this astroturf kind of grass, that you could see the gardener's footprints in the grass, and they put some dogs back there too, just so if the dogs barked, then they knew the gardener was there. It turns out that after months and months of waiting, no laser beams went off and sounded any alarms, and no barbed wire was moved at the top of the fence. The dogs weren't barking. The grass didn't detect any footprints. So Chris, being the skeptical one, he said, well, no, he likes apologetics. Ole, being the skeptical one, he said, you know, I think that there is no gardener. I think that we just fooled ourselves in believing there was one, and he's never going to come because he doesn't exist. So basically, they argued and argued back and forth. No, we should wait. There is a gardener. No, we shouldn't. There isn't a gardener. And so that's kind of how the story went, okay? And then it kind of ends like this. Chris, he says, well, he's trying to get Sony and Julie on his side so they can convince, you know, gang up on him and kick him off of the team, you know, Survivor. And Chris is saying, well, he's real. He's just someone that is weightless and he doesn't create footprints. And he doesn't need to climb a fence and go over barbed wire because he happens to be able to jump really high. And he actually is invisible, so these laser beams won't ever detect him. And he's odorless and he makes no noise, so the dogs would never be able to know he's there. And so then Ole says, you know, Chris, that sounds great. And, you know, Julie and Sonia are like, yeah, you know, that's a good point. And Chris is like, no, bad point. This gardener that you're talking about, there's no difference between him and an invisible, imaginary gardener. This gardener doesn't exist. Why? Because you've qualified him to death. You've created 1,000 qualifications that just killed your gardener off. So in other words, Fluke intended to hash this all out. Fluke intended that the assertion God exists dies slowly, inch by inch, with 1,000 qualifications. So when a Christian says God exists, he also has to say, but he's invisible, but he's intangible, but he's odorless, but he's inaudible, but he's tasteless, but unwilling to prevent evil and suffering, but completely undetectable. This is what the Christian has to do to make the phrase or the proposition God exists make any sense at all. But the problem is he's qualifying God to death so that there's no difference between God and not God. God becomes imaginary, or equal to an imaginary God, when we qualify him like this. So it seems this overly qualified God doesn't differ from an imaginary God. This God who is invisible, intangible, eternally elusive, might as well be imaginary or non-existent. So this is what Flew was implying with his parable. This is how he begins the essay. Now, he says later, years later, talking about his essay, he says, when the skeptic in the parable asked the believer, just how does what you call an invisible, intangible, eternally elusive gardener differ from an imaginary gardener, or even from no gardener at all, he was suggesting that the believer's earlier statement that God exists had been so eroded by qualification that it was no longer an assertion at all. It was no longer an assertion, it became an utterance. Flew makes the distinction between assertions and utterances. Assertions are meaningful things. Utterances are just noise. It's just babble talk. So there's no way to falsify the claim God exists because God is undetectable. This is what Flew is arguing. There's no way to falsify God exists. So when believers say there is a God who is invisible and tangible, eternally elusive, there's no way to falsify that claim. We can't find evidence that would count against God exists. There's no category of evidence that could falsify God exists. Because by definition, God is not detectable. We can't go reach and grab God. We can't just go see him whenever we want to. Well, this is you're getting onto something right here. That's a great remark. I'm gonna comment on that. Thank you for that. You guys are so quick. Okay, since a believer is unable to falsify the claim God exists, this claim is babble talk, like unicorns and mermaids. That's what we're saying to the non-Christian who holds this view. So therefore, all expressions about God are nonsense, noises being uttered, like God loves us. That's just nonsense. It's like the unicorn jumps high, you know, like, what are you saying, you know? So that's the idea with this. So Flew concludes this essay. He says, what would have to occur or to have occurred to constitute for you a disproof of the love of or the existence of God? And with this question, he's anticipating the believer's response, nothing, nothing you could say, nothing you could do, nothing you could show me would disprove God's existence. And Flew would say, aha. Flew would conclude that since nothing could count against God's existence, or God loves us, let's say, these claims have no meaning at all, since they can't be falsified by empirical data. So he is helping the Christian to see that we believe in a God that can't be falsified. And then he argues that that which can not be falsified is a meaningless thing. When you talk about him, you don't speak meaningfully. Okay, so that is falsification, the falsification principle. Now, all of these things go together. They're all, they all hinge upon this empirical verifiability stuff that we've been talking about the last few weeks. So what are the implications of all of these views? Well, God exists and God does not exist are meaningless statements. That's one implication. The concept of God is a nonsensical concept. The concept of God is religious language that can't be properly communicated or understood even across subcultures. And lastly, compartmentalized religion into private reality is the effect of these views. So as religion is something that cannot give us meaningful statements about objective reality. So these are the implications. So according to atheist researcher James Thrower, religion became more of a perspective, an attitude, a way of looking at the world, rather than a descriptive account of how reality actually is. Remember, we were talking about objective reality. So with this, they compartmentalize religion and saying that if you have any religious views at all, they have to be subjective in nature, and you can't really talk about them in public. You have to hold that, keep that to yourself, and don't talk about it, because this concept that you're trying to convey is meaningless. So this, all that you're thinking is just a private sort of thought you have. It's like you're having a feeling, but we don't really care what you're feeling. it turns out that we kind of feel this, right? So this kind of gave rise to postmodernism and naturalism that we're going to talk about later. All right, so what are the criticisms of these views? So I have 3 minutes, if I'm going to stick to the 8:30 mark, to go through all of this. All right, so just throw things at me when you're ready to go. But I'll try to wrap this up here in a few minutes, okay? So the first thing we can say about this is that empirical data is not the only way to detect meaning. So meaning can be detected in other ways. When two parties agree on the referent object, something that's either abstract or concrete, doesn't matter, of an expression that's written or verbal or some action expression, like I'm waving my hand saying, or doing this saying, I need Jesus really bad, and this means I really, 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 really need Jesus. You know, something like I'm communicating to you with my actions. And you understand what I'm saying because we've all agreed on what that expression is, what that expression means. So meaning is not something that is empirically verifiable. So the first thing that they try to do is start with this view that that which is meaningful is something that is empirically verifiable. But it's not that's not the case. Meaning can be detected in many other ways. So let's keep going here. What if we go ahead? I'm sorry? Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's all kinds of ways we can communicate meaning, I think. Is that what you're getting at? Yeah, it's, and even meaning can be implied by things said or done. Right. Well, let's do this. Let's grant the truth of the verification principle for the sake of argument. Let's put it in its best light, let's say. And we can see that God actually satisfies the verification principle. So we can say that God is verifiable. I think, Leslie, you alluded to this already. Every time a miracle occurs or a spiritual experience happens, and when design in the universe is detected, we have empirical data to verify God exists. We don't necessarily have an ability to touch God, but we have the effects of God. We experience the effects of God. In this sense, given their own criteria, God actually does satisfy it. We can empirically verify where he has been. Now, the other thing we could say is that Jesus as God, or Jesus is God, let's say, can be falsified. So let's say that Jesus told that he was God. So let's grant the truth of the falsification principle for the sake of argument. We can see that Jesus as God actually satisfies this requirement. So Jesus claimed to be equal with Yahweh, right? Yahweh knows the future, right? And Yahweh doesn't lie, right? Well, Jesus prophesied his own resurrection, right? So Jesus would know the future and wouldn't lie, right? If he was wrong, he would not know the future and not lie, right? Therefore, he wouldn't share the same properties as God does, right? So he wouldn't be God. So if Jesus was not raised from the grave, our Christian faith is in vain, right? 1 Corinthians 15. The understanding of Jesus as incarnate God, and thus the whole Christian worldview, relies on the historicity of the resurrection, which was, in fact, empirically falsifiable. If Jesus' actual dead corpse was actually produced and shown to the world, after the disciples proclaim the resurrection, the Christian faith falls, as there is empirical evidence that counts against and falsifies the claim that Jesus rose from the grave. So there could be empirical evidence that we see, for instance, his corpse, that he was lying, he wasn't telling the truth, when he prophesied his resurrection, because he was dead. Jesus as God, then, that statement can be falsified. So even by the statement's own standards, Christianity still succeeds. So using this falsification principle, we still can beat it. Now, that may sound pretty crazy, what I just went through there, that if Jesus' dead corpse was produced and he wasn't resurrected, then Christianity falls. But I'm not making that up. I'm just talking about what Paul taught us in 1 Corinthians 15. And that's the power of the resurrection. That's why it's so incredible, especially for apologetics. So if we're on a boat, we're floating, there are dolphins. Right? I thought it was the Holy Spirit coming out. We're going to heaven here. That the resurrection, if Jesus is still dead, we shouldn't be here tonight. This building shouldn't be built. We'd be wasting our time. But the power of the resurrection is that he actually was not dead, and there is no corpse. I mean, this is amazing stuff here. So, the resurrection is empirically falsifiable, and Christianity is therefore empirically falsifiable. Now, let's see what else we could say here. The falsification principle's notion of meaning is mistaken. Oh, by the way, so if it's falsifiable or verifiable, then we've already communicated meaning. So we just tried to show that there. But now let's look at these things. Let's look at these principles in and of themselves. The falsification principle's notion of meaning is mistaken. So the major presuppositions to Flew's argument are as follows. He presupposes empirical data that can falsify is the only way to detect meaning. Well, we already addressed that in A. He says that God cannot be verified by empirical data. He just assumes this. We've already addressed that in B. He also says that God cannot be falsified. Well, we just addressed that. Okay, well, let's just continue granting it for the sake of argument. And let's look into this a little bit more. From Flew's famous essay on the invisible gardener and the falsification principle, we can see a few weaknesses, right? Flew was right about how, if the gardener is explained with qualification after qualification, what we are left with is no gardener at all. So the gardener does die the death of 1,000 qualifications. He's right on that. However, Flew's notion of meaning was simply mistaken. He basically was saying that, with his notion of meaning, that if there is no empirical evidence that can count against a statement, then that statement has no meaning. That was his theory of meaning. So a statement such as God exists has no meaning because empirical evidence can count against that statement. That is, nothing can count against or falsify God exists. So this is his theory, right? So in the gardener story, the two or the four explorers knew the meaning of an undetectable gardener when they were disagreeing about it. So in order to discuss what an undetectable gardener was, that conversation between the four of them would have required undetectable gardener to be a meaningful thing. They would have known what undetectable gardener meant. In fact, they would have known what a gardener was. They would have known what tools a gardener had. They would have known what gardener business cards typically look like, a guy with a lawnmower and the logo. They would have known what a gardener union was. You know, these sorts of things. The concept of gardener was already meaningful before the conversation started. In fact, the concept of gardener had to be meaningful in order for the conversation to take place. The conversation presupposes gardener as a meaningful topic. And interestingly, those in the Oxford Symposium, when Flew was delivering his groundbreaking paper, would have known that this gardener parable implied something that had to do with God being a meaningless concept. They would have reasoned that Flew was talking about God when he went through this parable. So the people in the audience knew the meaning behind what gardener was analogous to. So meaning is not lost, and meaning has really nothing to do with empirical falsifiability, like Flew just assumed. And for communication to even occur, based on Flew's own line of reasoning, meaning had to be presumed. The fact that the gardener or God can't be falsified, it has nothing to do with meaningless. It has everything to do with God or the gardener is the best explanation for the garden or creation. So this requires consideration of what we call the teleological argument, which we'll talk about later in this course. And believe it or not, intelligent design. And what's behind detecting a gardener? Or can we detect design or a designer? So this gardener parable really has nothing to do with meaning. It has everything to do with whether or not the gardener hypothesis or the God hypothesis is the correct one. That God exists or the gardener is there is true or false. It really has to do with that. Is there a God or is there not a God based on the arrangement of the flowers? Do we detect a highly ordered arrangement of the flowers in the garden? Do we detect certain types of trees, pines over here, deciduous over here, and so forth? Do we detect a pattern in how these things were arranged? Do they form a hexagon or something? You know, these are the sorts of things that intelligent design theorists try to understand in order to know how to detect design. So the question is whether or not there is a God or there is not a God, and that question is answered based on the evidence, based on the empirical data that you can look and observe and get in the garden. And then you can understand whether or not the God hypothesis or the gardener hypothesis is the best one, or it's the worst one. So that's the idea with this. And so Flew's critique or Flew's approach does not show meaninglessness or meaningfulness. It really just shows how to see if something is true or false. What level of evidence is really there? So we're back to truth or falsity, and that's where we want to be. Okay, so the fifth thing we could say is that Hume's fork is self-refuting. Now, I purposefully left out the discussion in the first part about Hume's fork because I thought we may run out of time, which we have. So there are two last things I'd like to tell you, though, and then I'll let you go at about 11:30. the two last things are the big ones, and then we'll end here, okay? We'll go quick. The verification principle and the falsification principle throws too much out, which leads to absurdity. Okay, so if we really take these things and we say, yeah, these are good ideas, let's build a worldview off of this. Well, these principles require much of what we know to be rejected as meaningless, and this would result in absurdity. So basically, all ethical statements would be discarded. They would say that ethical statements are basically emotions I'm expressing. So when I say abortion is wrong, they say that I have this distaste that comes to my mouth when I think of abortion, and I don't like it, it doesn't feel good, something inside me gets all queasy. That's what I'm expressing, actually, when I say abortion is wrong. Or when I say kicking toddlers in the face for the fun of it is wrong. They say, oh, you're just saying that you don't like that, just like you're saying you don't like peppermint. Well, I like peppermint. You like chocolate? I hate chocolate. It's nasty to me. That's kind of it's like an emotive sort of thing that is happening, that I'm communicating when I'm speaking about ethical things. That's what they would say ethical statements are. And so this is just absurd, though. I mean, they communicate ethical statements right back when you go steal their stereo out of their car. You know, they're not talking about their emotions. They're talking about what I just did was morally wrong. And so you get the idea that this leads to absurdity. So let's look at it in terms of beauty. So statements about beauty would be meaningless, as they cannot be verified or falsified. But this is just absurd. It's simply false, as we are not discussing our feelings when we are talking about something being beautiful or ugly. So even if someone says, well, beauty is subjective or beauty is objective, we are still referring to the thing in itself when we're making ethical statements, whether beauty is subjective or objective, it doesn't matter. When we talk about something being beautiful, we're still talking about that thing over there. And so we're not just describing emotion. And that's what they have to say all this stuff is, ethical statements, statements about beauty, and definitely statements about God are just meaningless emotional expressions that we're conveying. But this is absurd. It's just not the case. It results in absurdity. So there's a thing in philosophy and logic called reductio ad absurdum. It's Latin for reducing something to its absurd conclusions or taking something to its absurd results to show that the original thing is ridiculous. And that's what is happening here. And by the way, Jesus did that. I encourage you to go find this when he was talking to the Pharisees. He used what's called a reductio ad absurdum argument. And I won't give that away, but check that out. Now, even many scientific statements would have to be discarded as emotional expressions because you can't go empirically verify quarks. So when the physics professors and scientists talk about quarks, they're actually just talking about emotions. That's absurd. Like, that's what this view would result in, this kind of absurdity. When they're talking about string theory and the multiverse, they're really just telling us about their feelings. It's just a psychological, you know, counseling sort of conversation happening. That's just absurd. And so when we start to see the results of this view, we can see that the view is absurd. All right, so these views are too restrictive, and therefore they should be rejected. And finally, we see One of the best things about this class I think we've seen so far is that everything we've talked about is self-refuting. So if it's self-refuting, there's no way anybody can believe this. So listen to what this commentator, how he puts it. The verifiability principle fails its own test since it is not itself an empirically verifiable statement. It is therefore embarrassingly meaningless. So this is crazy. In other words, the verification principle and the falsification principle are self-refuting because they themselves are not capable of being verified or falsified. So you can't take the verification principle and verify it. You can't take the falsification principle and falsify it. Therefore, by their own standards, they are themselves meaningless. And in fact, you take it a little further, when someone says to you the verification principle or the falsification principle, they are just spitting out meaningless babble, making noises. That's what really is happening. These statements could never be empirically verified or falsified.
Do you think that these comments that you're making about what these people said would survive the Hegelian method? I don't think so. I think when Hegel came along, they fell apart.
I will answer this by saying these statements they have made, they have recognized a few years later to be self-refuting. So when we, to finish this, we can see that this view or this philosophical movement died a quick death. So as we've seen that these statements are meaningless babble, they are self-refuting, and you can't think about them, you can't communicate something that's meaningless, the philosophers of history have noted that these views were short-lived. Logical positivism is now dead, and many of the logical positivists had already come to question some of their previous assumptions. And so you can see here, there's a few quotes I've given you that talks about how this view and these philosophical movements quickly failed, and no philosopher holds to verificationism. Even A.J. Ayer, who continued to have the movement, he tried to keep it going in the 60s and 70s, even he failed at that. And so it died basically a quick death. And I'm sorry? Well, they went into analytic philosophy more, you know. And what happened, though, this is the problem. Even though in academic philosophy it died completely, and everybody recognizes that who thinks about what happened with philosophy during that time, everyone recognizes that the people on the street are still regurgitating this stuff. It generationally trickles down from the ivy towers of academia to us. And so we kind of get their sewage in a sense, and we, you know, eat it up and spit it out. So this last quote here, William Lane Craig, he says about Flew's falsification principle, that it is scarcely a blip on the philosophical radar screen. So it went in and out of popularity in terms of academic philosophy, and again, it contributed to the rise of postmodernism, which we'll be talking about in a few weeks. And also existentialism kind of came out of this too. And so we'll be talking about that. So you can start to see these things overlap on each other and influence each other. And we're still dealing with this, as you saw that 1,000 atheists voted this to be the top charge against Christianity on YouTube a few years ago. You know, so we're still dealing with this, but it turns out that it's a terrible, terrible philosophical position. All right, so now that it's 8:30 sharp, I'll let you go. Sorry about that. I really tried this time. I think there's a lot of discussion at the beginning. It's your fault. I try to blame you. No, we'll just have to go straight into it right at 7. So, would someone like to close us in prayer?